Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo, Cedar Falls, The Courier for Wednesday, February 17th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. We're expecting a mostly cloudy and cold day today, with a high of 11 degrees, winds coming from the southeast between 6 and 12 miles per hour. Tonight, we go down to 0 degrees under mostly cloudy skies, and winds tonight will be southeast from 3 to 6 miles per hour. As we look around the region, mostly cloudy and cold today and tonight. Frostbite to exposed skin within 15 minutes. Cold tomorrow with times of clouds and sun. Friday, sunny to partly cloudy and cold. So far this season, we've had 45.2 inches of snow. An average season so far would only have 26 inches of snow. Articles on the front page include Winter Takes Deadly Turn, Counties Meetings All Gloom and Zoom, Public Health Expert Grilled on Vaccines by Lawmakers, and we begin with Bill Requires Pledge at School. Bill would have Iowa join other states in requiring Pledge of Allegiance in school. Stories filed by James Lynch, and begins with a photograph taken inside the State House of Representatives with the caption, State representatives stand at their desks during the Pledge of Allegiance in the Iowa House chambers, June 3rd, at the State House in Des Moines. Des Moines, Representative Christina Bohannon still loves to say the Pledge of Allegiance. Quote, no matter how many thousands of times I've repeated it, it always makes me feel reverent and proud to be an American. The freshman Democrat from Iowa City said Tuesday, in encouraging passage of a bill requiring Iowa K-12 schools to administer the pledge and show the U.S. flag every day. The bill's sponsor, freshman Representative Carter Nordman, Republican from Adel, rejecting arguments that the bill imposes another mandate on schools. Rather, it could be, quote, an opportunity for teachers to begin teaching the real meaning of the Pledge of Allegiance. Iowa, he added, is one of a few states without a law addressing the pledge. Quote, we don't pledge our allegiance to a government. We don't pledge our allegiance to a person or leader, Nordman said. We pledge our loyalty to an idea, the American idea, unquote. House File 415 would require accredited and non-accredited K-12 schools to administer the pledge on a daily basis and to show the U.S. flag while the pledge is recited. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1943 that forcing students to recite the pledge is a violation of the First Amendment, so students and parents could opt out. Reciting the pledge may cause students to think critically about the pledge and whether the nation is living up to those words, Bohannon said before H.F. 415 was passed at a vote of 93-0. Quote, our kids might ask whether our republic can last when many of our leaders refuse to denounce those who subvert our democracy, the University of Iowa law professor said. Quote, they might ask how we can be one nation indivisible if those in power pass election laws to suppress the votes of their fellow Americans. They might ask whether we have liberty and justice for all if transgender people are denied their liberties and black Iowans are more than 10 times more likely to be incarcerated than whites, unquote. That may provide a lesson in what makes America great, Nordman said. Quote, we can be on complete opposite sides of the political spectrum, he said. Quote, we can disagree, we can have those debates, but at the end of the day, we all know we're united under one flag, unquote. Republican Iowa legislator grills state public health expert with anti-vaccination question. Stories filed by Aaron Murphy. Des Moines. An Iowa lawmaker posed a series of anti-vaccination questions to one of the state's top public health experts Tuesday during a hearing on a proposal to bar businesses from requiring employees to be vaccinated. Senator Jim Carlin, Republican from Sioux City, chaired the Senate hearing on the legislation, which would bar businesses, including hospitals and other health care providers, from using people's vaccination history to determine employment. The bill would also allow students to seek exemptions from school vaccine requirements. The bill was introduced as the COVID-19 vaccine is being distributed throughout the country. Such hearings typically feature rapid-fire comments from dozens of organizations and individuals interested in a bill. Tuesday's hearing, for a time, featured Carlin asking a series of questions from an anti-vaccination former health care worker who said she quit her job because she refused to receive the flu shot. Carlin then grilled Dr. Caitlin Padotti, the state epidemiologist. Carlin said he has seen cases where vaccinations have led to personal injury, and asked Padotti questions like why chronic disease appears to be more prevalent and why autism is more frequently diagnosed than when he was a student. Padotti told Carlin that vaccines, including the COVID-19 vaccine, are run through rigorous testing processes to ensure they are safe and effective, not only before development, but also after. She said vaccines are, quote, absolutely critical public health tools, unquote. Quote, what's important to know is the benefit and the impact of these really awful diseases that used to spread widespread disease and death, Padotti said. Quote, children used to die routinely of diseases that I've never seen before because of vaccines. Vaccines continue to be a critical and remarkable life-saving tool that I think are incredibly important in keeping people safe and healthy here, unquote. The rest of the hearing's public comment period featured a mixture of people who supported the legislation, largely stating their concerns with vaccinations in general, and public health and infectious disease experts who relayed the important role of vaccines in fighting infectious diseases. Carlin said his proposal aims to balance the interests of businesses and healthcare facilities that want their workers to receive the COVID-19 vaccine against, quote, a person's legitimate interest in having autonomy over their own body, unquote. He also expressed concern that businesses would use information in a state database to determine whether Iowans have received the COVID-19 vaccine and use that information to prevent anyone who has not received the vaccine from patronizing or working at their business. A state public health department official said businesses would not have access to any state database with that kind of personal health information. Carlin, who on Monday announced his intention to run for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Senator Chuck Grassley, said he anticipates, quote, both sides of the debate from medical and public health experts who are concerned about the spread of a deadly virus and people who believe every individual should have the right to determine whether they receive a vaccine. Carlin and Senator Mark Costello, a Republican from Emoging, said they have received an outpouring of public support for the legislation. They voted to move the legislation on to the next step in the process. Senate File 193 is now eligible for consideration by the Senate Committee on Commerce. Senator Pam Jochim, a Democrat from Dubuque, declined to support the legislation. A similar bill, House File 330, has been introduced in the House. Several are dead from a winter storm, story filed by Brian Anderson of the Associated Press, and it begins with a photograph taken outdoors on a snowy day with two men dressed in warm clothing climbing over a pile of downed trees, and one of them is carrying a red gas can. And the caption says, two men climb over downed trees as they head out to retrieve gas for generators Tuesday in Huntington, West Virginia, following a winter weather system. Ocean Isle Beach, North Carolina. A winter storm that left millions without power in record-breaking cold weather claimed more lives Tuesday, including three people found dead after a tornado hit a seaside town in North Carolina, and four family members who perished in a Houston area house fire while using a fireplace to stay warm. The storm that overwhelmed power grids and immobilized the southern plains carried heavy snow and freezing rain into New England and the Deep South and left behind painfully low temperatures. Wind chill warnings extended from Canada into Mexico. At least 20 deaths were reported. Other causes included car crashes and carbon monoxide poisoning. The weather also threatened to affect the nation's COVID-19 vaccination effort. President Joe Biden's administration said delays in vaccine shipments and deliveries were likely. North Carolina's Brunswick County had little notice of the dangerous weather, and a tornado warning was not issued until the storm was already on the ground. The National Weather Service was, quote, very surprised how rapidly this storm intensified, and the time of night when most people were at home and in bed, it creates a very dangerous situation, Emergency Services Director Ed Conroe said. In Chicago, a foot and a half of new snow forced public schools to cancel in-person classes for Tuesday. The worst U.S. power outages were in Texas, affecting more than 2 million homes and businesses. More than 250,000 people also lost power across parts of Appalachia, and another 200,000 were without electricity after an ice storm in northwest Oregon, according to PowerOutage.us, which tracks utility outage reports. 4 million people lost power in Mexico. Texas officials requested 60 generators from the Federal Emergency Management Agency and planned to prioritize hospitals and nursing homes. The state opened 35 shelters to more than 1,000 occupants, the agency said. More than 500 people sought comfort at one Houston shelter. Mayor Sylvester Turner said other warming centers were closed because they lost power. Utilities from Minnesota to Texas implemented rolling blackouts to ease the burden on power grids, straining to meet extreme demand for heat and electricity. Blackouts lasting more than an hour began around dawn Tuesday for Oklahoma City and more than a dozen other communities, stopping electric-powered space heaters, furnaces, and lights just as temperatures hovered around minus 8 degrees. Oklahoma Gas and Electric rescinded plans for more blackouts, but urged users to set thermostats at 68 degrees Fahrenheit, avoid using major electric appliances, and turn off lights or appliances not in use. However, Entergy began rolling blackouts Tuesday night in Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Southeast Texas, at the direction of its grid manager, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. Quote, as a last resort, and in order to prevent more extensive, prolonged power outages that could severely affect the reliability of the power grid, according to a statement from the New Orleans-based utility. Entergy has almost 3 million electric power customers in the four states. Nebraska's blackouts came amid some of the coldest weather on record. In Omaha, the temperature bottomed out at 23 degrees below zero overnight, the coldest in 25 years. The Southwest Power Pool, a group of utilities covering 14 states, said the blackouts were, quote, a last resort to preserve the reliability of the electric system as a whole, unquote. The outages forced a Texas county to scramble to administer more than 8,000 doses of Moderna's coronavirus vaccine after a public health facility lost power early Monday and its backup generator also failed, said Rafael Lemaitre, a spokesman for Harris County Judge Linda Hidalgo. County officials distributed the doses that could have spoiled at three hospitals, Rice University, and the county jail because there were large groups of people available who would not have to drive and appropriate medical personnel present. Quote, it feels amazing. I'm very grateful, said Harry Golan, a college sophomore who waited for nearly 4 hours with his friends, much of it in the cold, and was among the last people to get the shots, which otherwise would not have reached students until March or April. Texas officials said more than 400,000 doses due now will not arrive until at least Wednesday because of the storm. The tornado hit North Carolina's Brunswick County was an EF3, with winds estimated at 160 miles per hour, the Weather Service said on Twitter. Three people died and 10 were injured when the tornado tore through a golf course community and another rural area just before midnight Monday, destroying dozens of homes. Authorities in multiple states reported deaths and crashes on icy roads, including two people whose vehicle slid off a road and overturned in a waterway in Kentucky on Sunday, state police said. A Mississippi man died after losing control of his vehicle, which overturned on an icy road Monday night. County's meetings, all gloom and Zoom. Lagging internet pushes Blackhawk County to examine existing broadband connection. Stories filed by Sydney Sizon. And it begins with a daytime photo taken of the exterior of the county courthouse. Waterloo. Virtual meetings during COVID-19 catapulted Zoom and other forms of electronic communication to the forefront of local government. Black Hawk County is now exploring ways to improve its broadband connection. County employees complained at a Tuesday work session of a sluggish internet connection and muffled audio issues. Supervisor Craig White said residents told him they struggled to listen and watch the meeting on video, which is offered to officials and residents live on Zoom or afterwards on YouTube. A representative from Computer Consultants, ACES, said the Zoom connection problems could be the county's firewall or network security system that monitors people who enter and exit calls. He said the county's broadband infrastructure, which consists of copper cables about 15 years old, could be contributing to the slower connection speeds. New cables could handle higher internet speeds being offered by broadband companies. ACES said the county previously asked to turn off firewall protection to improve Zoom meeting quality. Kim Veder, Information Technology Director, said she would request that action again if it meant improving Zoom quality. James Nehring, Chief Information Officer at Marshall County, said part of the Zoom issues seemed to come from microphones and the setup of the second-floor conference room at the Black Hawk County Courthouse. He said a microphone meant to capture sound from public speakers catches sound from the county supervisors who are speaking from the opposite direction. Supervisor Linda Leyland was especially difficult to hear. Officials did not say whether her microphone was encountering separate issues. Supervisor Chris Swartz questioned whether the audio could be wired directly into the laptop hosting the Zoom meeting. Tom Little said he felt lavalier microphones, which typically clip onto clothing, could enhance audio quality. Nafisa Sissy Iboigne, Health Department Director, said the county's Zoom calls for weekly COVID-19 vaccine planning meetings are interrupted by frozen screens caused by poor connection. James Perry, County Finance Director, said he experiences pop-ups on his computer saying the internet connection is unstable. T.J. Koningsfield, County Assessor, said his office encounters the same messages even though they got new broadband cables more recently than other departments. Grant Veder, County Auditor, asked whether people using their phone for audio and computer for video would improve connection to Zoom calls. The ACES representative said it could work by giving more bandwidth for users to have video and audio coming from different devices. Nehring said he would bring equipment to Black Hawk County next week that could improve the tech issues. He said he would allow the IT department to test the equipment for free. Black Hawk County currently gets internet services from Cedar Falls Utilities, a city-owned utility provider. Waterloo is exploring the possibility of creating its own municipal utility to offer broadband services, and it expects to release a study on the matter in May at the earliest. Now we turn to the Cedar Valley page, and let's read the Call the Courier column. Question: why do you keep printing the Sudoku puzzle on the fold line? Answer: where the puzzle is placed on the page depends on the ads it shares the page with. Question: why didn't Chief Justice Robert preside over the impeachment trial of President Trump? Answer: because President Donald Trump was no longer president. When sitting presidents are tried, the Constitution requires that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court preside. But when non-presidents are tried, the President pro tempore of the Senate, in this case, Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, has historically presided, Leahy said, before the trial began. Question: is it true that over 30,000 Republicans have left the Republican Party after the Capitol was infiltrated? Answer: an analysis of January voting records this week by the New York Times found that nearly 140,000 Republicans had quit the party in 25 states that had readily available data. Question: why has the Call the Courier column been missing so much from your paper? Answer: For some reason, we have received fewer questions in recent months, leaving us without enough material to run the column every day. Question. In Sunday's paper, you had an article about Joan Ann Bauer. What was the book they were holding? Answer. The book was, quote, The Most Fun We Ever Had, unquote, by Claire Lombardo. Goodreads.com describes the 2019 title as, quote, a multi-generational novel in which the four adult daughters of a Chicago couple, still madly in love after 40 years, recklessly ignite old rivalries until a long-buried secret threatens to shatter their lives they've built. Question. Where is Doughy Joey's relocating to? Answer. The pizza restaurant announced in December that it is moving to 300 West 4th Street in Waterloo, opening sometime in early 2021. Doughy Joey's formerly had a restaurant there before consolidating operations in Cedar Falls. The Cedar Falls location closed last year, and the building was torn down after the property was sold to build a DePaco Community Credit Union branch. Question. Why is Jane Lindemann making parents take their kids back to school? What happens if we decline? East and West High Schools in Waterloo switched from a hybrid schedule to fully in-person starting February 1st. Students were already in the buildings half of the time. Waterloo Community School Superintendent had long stated the hope of bringing students back full-time, so officials had been evaluating the effectiveness of mitigation strategies to determine whether that would be possible. If you don't want to send your child to school in person, then you can sign up for 100% remote learning from home through the district. Question. Were Castle Hill and River Hills considered private or public schools? Answer. They were both public schools, and River Hills still is, since it remains open. Castle Hill started out as an elementary building in the Waterloo Community Schools. The facility was later leased to what is now Central Rivers Area Education Agency as a special education preschool and K-8 behavior program. River Hills School in Cedar Falls was built to serve special needs students and has always been operated by the AEA. Waverly approves sidewalk infill program, but Ward 3 mostly exempt from the rules. Story filed by Amy Rivers. Waverly. The city will require owners of most vacant lots to build sidewalks to, quote, improve the overall connectivity. But one council member made sure it won't apply to older parts of town. City engineer Mike Cherry drafted the subdivision sidewalk infill program criteria at the request of the city council in January, which noted it preferred a comprehensive plan instead of the practice of reviewing individual lots each year. Quote, we're trying to put something together that fits the discussion of the council at the prior meeting, Cherry said. The resolution would require any lot built upon a subdivision that required sidewalk at the time of platting have a sidewalk, a requirement in Waverly since 2013. But it would add a requirement for sidewalks on vacant lots that were more than 6 years old, as well as vacant lots whose owners hadn't obtained a building permit within 2 years of ownership in developments that were more than 6 years old. Property owners whose vacant lots are next to two or more adjacent vacant lots, as well as those vacant lots next to underdeveloped land, would not be required to add a sidewalk. Cherry said violators would be contacted January 1st of each year and ordered to complete a sidewalk by Labor Day. If a sidewalk is not built by then, the city will build it and assess property owners, who would then have to make the first payment by September of the following year, paid over either a 5 or 10 year period. That worried Ward 4 Councilwoman Heather Beaufort. Quote, I'm just concerned with forcing anybody to commit to something financially they can't do right now, she said, noting the ongoing economic recession caused by the pandemic. Quote, there's also the possibility they could appeal to the city council specifically for an exemption, Ward 5 Councilman Tim Kangas said. We could give them a grace period of a year. There is another path there. Ultimately, the council unanimously approved the program, which was adopted Monday, but not before Ward 3 Councilman Rodney Drenkow made sure it wouldn't apply to much of his ward, which he noted in the January meeting had several large trees and other considerations. Quote, I don't think there's any reason to be using this to force people to build a sidewalk where there haven't been sidewalks for over 100 years, Drinkow said. Cherry said the way the resolution was written would not include platting before the city had council and zoning records, or around 1975 and before. But Kanga said it didn't mean Ward 3 would be totally off the hook forever. Quote, that's an issue the future council would have to deal with in terms of infill and connectivity through parts of town that had never had them before, and that would be specific to those areas, he said. Cedar Falls parking free until August. The move is meant to ease the pandemic squeeze on local businesses. Filed by Amy Rivers. Cedar Falls. Seeing downtown business owners were just really trying to survive at this point, the director of a business group asked the city council to consider letting people park for free in municipal lots around the city until April of next year. That was deemed to be too long by the council, which approved continuing the suspension for 4 months until August 1st on a 6-1 vote. Ward 2 Councilwoman Susan DeBurr dissented. Paid parking in the city's municipal lots was up and running for just a month before being suspended due to the pandemic's economic effects. In December, Community Main Street, which represents downtown businesses, asked for a suspension during the crucial holiday shopping season, which the council granted until April 1st. But the group's director, Kim Baer, wrote another letter on behalf of member businesses last week, asking for the suspension to be extended through April 2022. She also asked the council to reinstate the ordinance allowing four-hour parking, as well as bringing back parking passes. Quote, we appreciate the current paid parking pause, Baer wrote. Quote, however, we feel that the pandemic is far from over, and the businesses are in need of this measure of support, unquote. At-large Councilman Dave Sires wanted to know what businesses themselves thought of paid parking in general. Baer said they weren't able to look that far into the future yet. Quote, our board members had multiple conversations with our businesses downtown who are just really trying to survive at this point, Baer replied. Quote, we can't implement the paid parking right now in the circumstances that are surrounding us, unquote. Jennifer Rodenbeck, City Director of Finance and Business Operation, reiterated her concerns for a long-term suspension of the paid parking system, including roughly $1,600 per month in expenses that would continue to drain the parking fund until it would fall back on the general fund. Quote, if we would continue to do that for a year and not use them, that's about $20,000 cost that we would have, Rodenbeck said. Quote, if we see that there's not a tolerance for paid parking, then we should pull the paid stations out and reduce our costs, unquote. City Administrator Ron Gaines noted he didn't know of any COVID-related funds from either the state or the federal government that would cover the city's costs on parking expenses. Council members noted they weren't in favor of eliminating paid parking altogether, with Ward 5 Councilman Frank Dara noting Community Main Street itself requested the parking study because of the previous parking congestion. Quote, I think when we get out of the pandemic, which will happen, we will have a parking problem again, said Ward 4 Councilman Simon Harding, before making the motion to extend the suspension until August 1st. Others similarly sounded optimistic that businesses would rebound sooner than next April. Quote, I think the August 1st date sounds reasonable at this point to get us out there where the vaccine can start kicking in and people feel comfortable returning, said Ward 3 Councilman Darrell Cruz. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Wednesday, February 17th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Helen Ann Baker, age 89, of Applington, Iowa, was born the daughter of Arthur and Mary, maiden name Nay, Davis, on January 7, 1932, near Swan, Iowa, the youngest of seven children. She attended elementary school in Oskaloosa, Iowa, part of her eighth grade year in Beverly Hills, California, and high school in Applington, Iowa, and she graduated in 1950. On September 6, 1953, Helen was united in marriage with Herman Baker at the Little Brown Church in Nashua, Iowa. The couple made their home and lived their entire married life in Applington and moved to a new home in 2014. Helen worked her teenage years as a telephone operator at the Applington Exchange and early married life as a nurse's aide at Maple Manor Nursing Home, but mostly she was a housewife and homemaker. Helen entered Maple Manor Village in Applington in November 2014 and resided there until she entered Unity Point Allen Hospital, Waterloo, on February 8, 2021. Helen was a former member of the Applington Baptist Church, the Ackley Christian Reformed Church, and the Applington First Presbyterian Church. She enjoyed reading, especially about the Amish, studying her Bible, embroidery, baking, gardening, feeding and watching her beloved songbirds, going out for breakfast with friends and family, and making long walks and car rides with her devoted husband and her son David's dogs. Her pride and joy were her four children, two granddaughters, and four great-grandchildren, whose phone calls, cards, and visits meant the world to her, especially after her entrance into Maple Manor. Since March 3, 2020, those visits were limited to outside her window due to the COVID restrictions. Helen passed away Thursday, February 11, 2021, under hospice care at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo, surrounded by her four children. She was preceded in death by her husband Herman on February 2, 2015, her parents, two brothers, Richard and George Davis, four sisters, Bernice Davis, Emma Davis, Doris Davis, and Martha Weisink, one brother-in-law, Lloyd Weisink, one sister-in-law, Cleta Davis, and one daughter-in-law, Lynn, spouse Reeve, Baker. Helen is survived by three sons, Stephen Baker of Cedar Falls, Randall Baker of Des Moines, and David Baker of Applington, one daughter, Kathleen, spouse Doug Johnson of Applington, two granddaughters, Sabrina, spouse Tanner Mai of Dyke, and Tabitha Johnson of Dyke, four great-grandchildren, Tariki and Taraya Johnson of Dyke, and Kendall and Weston Mai of Dyke, and many nieces and nephews. Funeral services will be 2 o'clock p.m. Saturday, February 20th, 2021, at Redmond Funeral and Cremation Services, Applington Chapel, with burial at Pleasant View Cemetery, both in Applington, Iowa. Visitation will be from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock p.m. Saturday at the Redmond Funeral and Cremation Services, Applington Chapel. Their phone number is area code 319-346-1534. Memorials may be directed to the family in care of Stephen Baker, Post Office Box 98, Applington, Iowa, 50604. Redmond Swartz Funeral Chapel in Applington is in charge of arrangements. Online condolences may be left at www.redmond-swartz.com. John Richard Eastman, 66, of Nishwa, passed away on Sunday, February 14, 2021, at his home in Nishwa, Minnesota. He was born on December 21, 1954, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Paul and Betty Eastman. He married Dana Haig on September 13, 1980, spending 40 happy years of marriage together. He worked many years in the local school system as a custodian. John was known for his quick wit and easy smile. He liked to laugh and share his love of fishing and the outdoors with his family and friends. In keeping with the wishes of John, there will be no funeral services. Memorials and condolences can be made directly to the family. Waterloo. Wendell James Ferguson, age 85, passed away Tuesday, February 16, 2021, at Unity Point Allen Memorial Hospital. He was born in Charlotte, Michigan on July 27, 1935, to James and Florence, maiden name Baker, Ferguson. He attended Charlotte High School and Western Michigan University, where he attained his BA. He served in the Air Force, then went on to work at Platt's Nursery in Davenport, and 30 years at Foster's Incorporated in sales. He married Joan Platt June 24, 1967, in Davenport, Iowa. She died July 26, 2010. Their children include Elizabeth, spouse Josh Bryant of Bondurant, and John Ferguson of Waterloo. There are three grandchildren, Ellie, Henry, and Max Bryant. He also leaves brothers Carlton, spouse Mary Ferguson of Greenville, Michigan, John, spouse Joe Ferguson of Mesa, Arizona, and several nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents and his wife. He was a member of Gideon's International and Cedar Falls Trees. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, February 19th, 2021, at Bethany Bible Chapel. Visitation is 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, February 18th, at Richardson Funeral Services, 615 Main Street, Cedar Falls, Iowa, who is in charge of arrangement. Memorials to Bethany Bible Chapel or Oak Ridge Bible Chapel. Cedar Valley leaders urge Representative Ashley Hinson to support COVID-19 relief bill. Story filed by Sydney Sison. Waterloo. A coalition of Cedar Valley leaders Tuesday called on U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson to support the proposed COVID-19 relief package that would give financial help to families, schools, businesses, unemployed people, local governments, and others. The leaders held a news conference on video platform Zoom, which was hosted by the Iowa Alliance for Retired Americans. Speakers who supported the relief bill included Blackhawk County Supervisor Chris Swartz, Waterloo Human Rights Commission Director, the Reverend Abraham Funches, Cedar Falls business owner Andrea Gary, and Sue Dinsdale, Executive Director of Iowa Citizen Action Network, and State Director of Iowa Lower Drug Prices Now. Hinson is a Republican who recently beat former U.S. Representative A.B. Finkenauer to represent Iowa's 1st District. She is serving a 2-year term. Swartz said the $350 billion in relief package slated for local and state governments would help mitigate the pandemic, help cover costs from COVID-19, and replace lost revenue. Blackhawk County would be eligible for about $25 million in supplemental funds, Swartz said, based on an estimate from the National Association of Counties. He said the funds could be used in Blackhawk County to create a permanent warming center, provide housing assistance, create infrastructure and jobs, and modernize the health department, which recently had its proposed budget cut by nearly $100,000 by the Board of Supervisors. Swartz and his fellow supervisor, Linda Leyland, voted against the cut. The federal minimum wage would increase by June 2025 to $15 per hour under the relief package. Hinson recently called the proposal divisive and said she would not support the increase. Quote, she's saying that lifting families out of poverty for doing honest, hard work is divisive. And that's frankly ridiculous, Swartz said. Funches said the COVID-19 relief package would give stability and dignity to residents who need it most, including people who need help paying rent or utilities. He said it would especially benefit the state's low-income residents. Quote, our neighbors are hurting, Funches said. Quote, this is real flesh and blood. These are real people here, unquote. He said his own experience contracting COVID-19 made him realize the physical and political asphyxiation caused by the pandemic. Funches said it took him more than a month to recover from the virus, which caused him to be prescribed a steroid and put on oxygen. Quote, people really can't breathe, and we need your help to supply that steroid, that oxygen, that will allow us to breathe again, Funches said. Mill Box Bakery business owner Andrea Gary said her primary goals include keeping people healthy and making sure her store survives. She praised the COVID-19 relief package for offering grants and low-interest loans to business owners, some of which specifically aim to uplift women and people of color. Quote, I know the last year has, as a small business owner, has forced me to be extremely creative and employ quite a bit of ingenuity to keep the business open, Carey said. Dinsdale said the COVID-19 relief bill should not be interpreted as a red or blue issue. She lauded the bill's funds to support COVID-19 testing, vaccine distribution, and added public health workers. She said increased lab capacity for COVID-19 tests and regular testing for schools would be beneficial. Quote, it has been nearly a year since Congress passed the CARES Act Coronavirus Relief Fund, Dinsdale said. Quote, now is the time for our elected representatives to take a strong stand, unquote. Bill would require parents to opt in for kids to learn about gender identity. Story filed by Rod Bossart of the Courier Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines, parents of elementary school students would have to provide written permission for their children to participate in instruction related to gender identity under a bill that cleared a Senate subcommittee on Tuesday. Senate File 167 provides that a student in first through sixth grades may opt out of instruction related to gender identity. Gender identity, for purposes of the bill, is defined as a gender-related identity of a person, regardless of the person's assigned sex at birth. Quote, the family is the most basic human social institution, and for the schools to insert themselves squarely between the parents and the child is simply unthinkable to me, said Senator Ken Rosenboom, Republican of Oskaloosa, one of two Republicans who voted to forward the bill to the full Senate Education Committee for consideration. The bill passed 2-1 over objections from representatives of education organizations, parents, teachers, students, and advocates on transgender, gender identity, and civil rights issues, who argued against heading down a slippery slope of excluding educational instruction based on legislative whims. Quote, we don't want the legislature dictating what we can and cannot be taught, because that doesn't benefit all students, said Phil Jennery, a lobbyist for Iowa Association of School Boards. Quote, this should really be a local decision, he added. Quote, most schools, if not all, already have a process for curriculum in the area that notifies the parents when it's going to be taught, and if there are issues, parents should be talking with the teachers, with the administration, or what can be done if they do have issues, and I think most schools, if not all, already have those avenues, unquote. Margaret Buckton, a lobbyist for organizations representing urban and rural schools, said school boards already have open and public process for parents and communities to have input when a curriculum is being adopted. Quote, we believe this is an intrusion in the role of the local school boards to make decisions based on their community values and those that elected them, Buckton said. She noted districts that had bought certain textbooks would incur a cost from the bill, which would represent an unfunded mandate. Paris Busick, a high school senior, told subcommittee members that instruction related to gender identity was vital to Iowa and established a culture of acceptance that is sorely needed to ensure diversity, equity, and inclusion in schools. Quote, if most students are not taught that gender identity is real, there is an increased potential for bullying and harassment for trans students in and beyond school. This discriminatory censorship sacrifices the safety of Iowa students, Basick said. Quote, Senate File 167 makes a sweeping discriminatory change that is baseless and contradicted by all evidence, unquote. Daniel Sunny countered that the proposed legislation offers elementary children, quote, some protection from indoctrination by gender theory activists, undermining parental teaching and ignoring biological reality, unquote. Chuck Hurley of the Family Leader Foundation said as a parent, he did not want his children exposed to this at all without me first being notified and having a chance to review the curriculum and opt my children out, unquote. Kenan Crow of One Iowa LGBTQ organization told the legislative panel, quote, everyone has a gender identity, not just transgender people, but there is no other topic specifically prohibited under the Iowa educational standards the way this one would be. Heather Dunn, a transgender woman and Iowa taxpayer, called the lawmakers to stop this agenda of hate, unquote. Danny Carroll, another family leader lobbyist, said the question at hand was merely whether parents should be asked to give their written permission. Quote, why wouldn't we want that? Unquote. But Sarah Chang argued bigger issues are at stake. Quote, it's a very slippery slope to call out certain topics from exclusion from the school curriculum, unquote, Chang said. If gender identity is not being unfairly singled out, where is the line drawn? Will students have to opt in to learn about various cultural identities, religious identities? If so, the whole social studies curriculum might as well become opt-in. If not, don't single out topics for exclusion from mention in the educational settings, unquote. Senate Committee Advances Effort to Boost Broadband Access, filed by Rod Bossart of the Courier Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines, bill seeking to build out major broadband expansions in Iowa, compensate college athletes, and streamline the process to determine recipient eligibility for public assistance programs, cleared Senate committees Tuesday after some robust debate. The Senate Commerce Committee unanimously approved the framework for Governor Kim Reynolds' priority to deliver $450 million over 3 years for grants to companies to extend broadband service to underserved areas. Senate Study Bill 1089 includes a three-tiered grant program, but it was clear senators increasingly are interested in projects offering download and upload speeds of 100 megabits per second. Quote, we want every Iowan, rural or urban, to feel like they're included in this big, robust bill, said Senator Kerry Golker, Republican of Dyersville, who noted money for the incentive will come later in a separate bill. For Iowa to be top of mind for workforce, we need it. For Iowa to be top of mind for quality of life, we need it. Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls, Democrat of Coralville, called the bill a very exciting piece of legislation that needs additional public input to achieve its intended goal. Senator Janet Peterson, Democrat of Des Moines, expressed concern that work needed to be done by subcommittee to ensure direct participation of Iowans rather than a process that now moves into closed-door discussions awaiting floor debate by the full Senate. Quote, there's a lot of taxpayer money that we're talking about and a great deal of power given to one person who is appointed by the governor, Peterson said. Quote, this is a big deal, she added. Quote, the last thing we need is a grant program where we find out somebody has gotten drunk with power and given out millions and millions of taxpayer dollars without community input, without some way of distributing these grants to the communities that need it most, unquote. Colker called the broadband bill a work in progress, adding, quote, it's kind of like a Christmas tree you put in the middle of the room and everyone shows up and they want some presents, unquote. Senate Commerce Committee members, on an 11-6 vote, approved a separate bill that directs the State Department of Human Services to upgrade its system of verifying eligibility for public assistance programs. Senate Study Bill 1125 proposes the agency buy a system or enlist a private vendor to verify assets, identity, and other eligibility requirements for hundreds of thousands of Iowans receiving federal and state benefits no later than July 1, 2022. Quote, the point of the bill is not to eliminate eligibility for people. It is to make sure that people who are applying are eligible, said Senator Jason Schultz, Republican from Schleswig, who added that modernizing the process could make the work faster, cheaper, and more accurate. Senator Liz Mathis, Democrat of Hiawatha, argued unsuccessfully that DHS officials already are working with a private company on a free one-year trial pilot project to verify data. A separate federal model is being prepared for states that should be available this spring, requiring a data-sharing agreement, but no purchase cost to the state. Quote, I believe that we don't need this bill, said Mathis, who called it pricey, pointless, and overly complex. Quote, it's a waste of taxpayer dollars when something coming down the pike is exactly what we need, she added, noting a similar bill previously carried an estimated state cost of $4 million. Quote, it feels like we are building something and then imposing it on a department that is already working toward trying to make the system better, unquote. And finally, the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously approved legislation that would allow student-athletes to profit from promotional use of their names, images, and likenesses as early as July. Quote, "This is really about fairness," said Committee Chairman Senator Brad Zahn, Republican from Urbandale. Senator Nate Bolton, Democrat of Des Moines, said Senate File 245 is similar to legislation enacted in six other states. Student-athletes in Iowa should not, quote, "have any lesser or fewer rights than athletes in other states," unquote. The NCAA announced January 11th it would postpone voting on proposals to change rules surrounding names, images, and likenesses after receiving a message from the U.S. Department of Justice Antitrust Division. However, Bolton and Zahn said states are looking at drafting their own laws because the NCAA hasn't acted on its promise to set national policy, and Iowa athletes, quote, "would be at a big disadvantage if nothing is done." And now on the sports page, Cedar Falls bowlers reach state, East girls in hunt for at-large bid, filed by Nick Petteros. Waterloo. The Cedar Valley's talented youth bowlers will once again be in the mix when the state championships return to Waterloo's Cadillac XBC earlier next week. One day after the Cedar Falls boys put together an eye-opening score of 3,315 to win their district at Cedar Rapids' Lancer Lanes, the Cedar Falls girls finished with a program record total of 3,042 during the 3A qualifying meet at Cadillac XBC. In Class 2A at Cadillac XBC, defending state champion Waterloo East's girls were edged by Western Dubuque in a closely contested title race, 2,782 to 2,757. The Trojans may still be able to secure one of the three at-large bids into the state. That won't be known until the final district in Des Moines takes place on Thursday. For the Cedar Falls girls, sophomore Anna Fram held Tuesday's championship performance with a 464 series, 205 and 259. That was good for second individually. Maya Brinker added a ninth place 426, 236 and 190. The Tigers excelled in the Baker rotation, combining to surpass 200 in the first four games before holding on to defeat Dubuque Hempstead by a total of 8 pins. Waterloo West finished fourth out of six 3A teams at Cadillac XBC with a score of 2,886. Sophomore Sydney Wilson led the Wahawks with a fourth place individual series of 438. 235 and 203, and junior Melanie Nelson was seventh at 430 at 236 and 194. In the 2A girls meet on Tuesday, East placed four bowlers in the top nine during the series portion. Mallory Carey led the way with a 414, 205 and 209, followed by a fourth place series from Jersey Benson at 398, 203 and 195. Western Dubuque had a 21-pin lead over East entering the Baker rotation and finished 25 pins ahead of the Trojans. In Class 1A, Waterloo Columbus finished fifth at Dubuque's Cherry Lanes with a 1,834 total. Host Dubuque Wallert won at 2,405. On Monday, Cedar Falls' entire boys team bowled above a 424 series. Matthew Swanson led the Tigers with a third place 464, 227, and 237, followed by teammate Christopher Fordyce, 461, 203, and 258. Cedar Falls recorded games of 249 and 230 in the Baker rotation. The Cedar Falls girls will bowl at state on Tuesday morning and the boys Tuesday afternoon next week in Waterloo. In college athletics, BARTA works to rebuild trust with swimmers, filed by Steve Batterson. Regardless of the outcome of ongoing legal issues, the University of Iowa is committed to a full reinstatement of its women's swimming and diving program and is open to the possibility of adding another women's sport, wrestling. Iowa Director of Athletics Gary BARTA emphasized those points Tuesday during a video conference saying despite ongoing financial issues created by the COVID-19 pandemic, the university is committed to continuing the women's swimming program it announced last August it was cutting. Barta delivered the message in person Monday to Iowa coaches and student athletes in the sport, seeking to end uncertainty over its future at a time when ongoing legal issues could cloud the matter for an extended period of time. He viewed the meeting as a starting point to rebuilding trust between athletics and university administrators and members of the program. That comes as Title IX complaint filed against the university in September by several current members of the women's swimming program continues, and a court order in December mandates the continuation of the program until legal matters are resolved. Quote, "To eliminate the uncertainty, I made the decision. We will fully reinstate the program as a full member of the athletics department," Barta said. Quote, "There is no looking back. Regardless of what happens in the legal process, women's swimming will remain at Iowa," unquote. That comes with a cost of about $1.5 million per year, money that will be found despite an expected budget deficit for the current fiscal year in the neighborhood of $50 million to $60 million. That figure is reduced from an initial estimate that Iowa's self-supporting Department of Athletics would have a budget shortfall of approximately $75 million for the fiscal year that ends June 30th. Those losses follow Iowa trimming about $25 million from its budget through salary reductions, eliminating positions, and cuts in the operating budgets of the 24 intercollegiate athletics programs Iowa offers. Revenue generated from a shortened football season played without fans in the stands, largely income from television rights, has trimmed some of the expected losses. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Wednesday, February 17th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned now for the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.